Omaha Public Radio presents another program from the Durham Museum Lecture Series on Noon Forum. We'll hear a talk by Ruth Rosenfeld, a survivor of the Nazi Holocaust. In recognition of Holocaust Remembrance Day, the Durham Museum has partnered with the Institute for Holocaust Education and the Jewish Federation, as well as Beth Israel, Bethel, and Temple Israel synagogues to co-sponsor this special presentation. Mrs. Rosenfeld, the mother of Jewish Community Center Omaha Executive Director Aaron Rosenfeld, was born in Wadowice, Poland. She has served as president of the Jewish Federation of Monmouth County, New Jersey, and has received the Hannah Solomon Award from the National Council of Jewish Women as the founder of Project Understanding, which is a dialogue group between Arabs and Jews. Part of the audience for today's program was made up of students from St. Cecilia's Grade School, Duchenne Academy, the Omaha Street School, as well as homeschool groups. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Tuesday morning, April 17, 2012, for broadcast at this time. The opinions expressed are those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent those of the Durham Museum, KIOS-FM, or the Omaha Public School District. Here now to introduce the program is Mick Hale, Director of Education at the Durham Museum.
Our guest today, Ruth Rosenfeld, was born in Poland, and she is a child survivor of the Holocaust and was orphaned by the age of three. Her mother, grandparents, aunt, and uncle were taken to Auschwitz, where they were murdered, and her father was killed before their capture. Rosenfeld and her sister, Helen, survived the Nazi horrors by each hiding with a different Christian family who put their own lives in jeopardy to care for the girls. At times, they were hidden in attics and floorboards and in barrels of poppy seeds in efforts to elude the Nazis. In 1949, after spending 3 years in a number of orphanages, Ruth and her sister were brought to America and adopted by an adoring family. Ruth married Dr. Gerald Rosenfeld and has been married to him since 1962. They have three children and six grandchildren. Her son Aaron is the executive director of the Jewish Community Center here in Omaha. She's been a volunteer in many communal organizations. And she, 2 years ago, she and her family participated in a ceremony in Poland recognizing her rescuer, Julia Walla, as a righteous among the nations. Ladies and gentlemen, it is my great pleasure to introduce to you Ms. Ruth Rosenfeld.
Thank you very much. Good morning, everybody. I want you to think about the many, many millions of people who lost their lives in Nazi Germany's death camps because of one evil man. 6 million of them were Jews murdered by the Nazis. Although it wasn't just Jews who were persecuted by the Nazis, Catholics, communists, homosexuals, psychiatric patients, gypsies, mentally handicapped were also victims. However, only the Jews were targeted. They were singled out for annihilation. There was no way out for a Jew. Converting didn't help. If you had one great-grandparent who was Jewish, if you had a trace of Jewish blood, you were doomed. Of the 6 million Jews who were murdered, 1.5 million of them were children. Only 11% of Jewish children survived. Just to give you an idea of what that number means, this is an approximation, but if I count off 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, you're all dead. You survived, and you continue. That's to give you a sense of the magnitude. Now, I don't know about you, but I have a very hard time comprehending these kinds of numbers. And yet it's terribly important for us to understand that each of these numbers was a human being with a face, a name, hopes and dreams, talents that simply were wiped out. How do we put flesh and bone, heart and soul into each of these numbers? I'm sure you've read books. You've probably seen some films, maybe Schindler's List or Paperclips, or we go to museum exhibits. And while the possibility still exists, we meet with the survivors and we listen to their stories. Because I am one of the fortunate 11% who survived, I consider it my sacred obligation to share my story with you. Mine is not a horror story. I was not in a concentration camp. But I did witness some horrible things. And there were times when I was terribly frightened, sad, and hungry. My story is about the compassion, courage, and morality of some good people who saved my life, have enabled me to live with optimism, and whose example has inspired me, as I hope it will inspire you, to emulate those qualities. My parents, born and raised in Wadowice, Poland. It's a medium-sized town, about an hour from Krakow. Krakow was at one time the capital of Poland, and also not far from Auschwitz. If there are any Catholics in the room, you probably would be very interested to know that Pope John Paul II was also born and raised in Wadowice, Poland. My father, Aaron, was one of 11 children. His father, Shraga, good-hearted and dedicated to the poor in spite of his own poverty. It is reported in a memorial book from our town that the Nazis made my grandfather dig his grave with his bare hands, and then they shot and killed him. My mother, Sarah, was one of 5 children. Her parents, David and Rachel, or Renia in Polish, they were well-educated, middle-class, and very religious. Both of my parents were active in the Zionist movement and had planned on going to Palestine, as Israel was called then. There was no Israel at that time. Unfortunately, they were trapped and were unable to fulfill their dreams. 2 of my father's sisters, Chava and Naomi, had already gone to Palestine. When my parents married, they moved to a larger city called Bielsko. It was about an hour from Wadowice. My sister Helenka was born there. My father was active in the Communist Party. Now, remember, in those times, communism was not the dirty word that it is nowadays. It was at the beginning, and it was an idealistic movement. It turned out to be a failure, but nevertheless, my father was active in the Communist Party, and he was a very outgoing man, had many friends, both Jews and non-Jews. When the Nazis invaded Poland in 1939, my parents went back to Wadowice and moved in with my mother's parents. At first, the conditions were not that bad. The Nazis did make my father and my uncles work as slaves digging ditches, but somehow they managed to stave off poverty. My parents did try to change their fate. My mother and father, with Helenka, and my mother's 2 brothers, Isaac and Jacob. They were 18 and 19 years old. The youngest one, Aaron, is among the 1.5 million children who were murdered. At any rate, my parents, with my sister and my uncles, snuck out in the middle of the night and traveled a great distance to reach the Sanz River, which divided Nazi-occupied Poland from Russian-occupied Poland. On two consecutive nights, they tried to cross the river, only to be shot at from the Russian side. Ultimately, my mother said that she could not try it again. Helenka was less than a year old. She was wet and cold and crying. My two uncles eventually did succeed in getting across and survived the war in Russia. My parents went back to Vadovice, where my mother organized a class teaching women how to sew. It was thought that if you had an essential skill, the Nazis needed uniforms sewed and so forth. So if you knew how to sew, it was an essential skill. It was thought that if you had a skill that the Nazis could use, that your life might be spared. Well, weeks went by with no word from my uncles. Everyone was worried what had happened to them. Had they reached safety? How were they living? What was their emotional state? The mail was slow and it was censored, but eventually a letter did arrive. And this is my grandmother's response to Jacob and Isaac's letter. I hope that you can appreciate what it means for me to hear my grandmother's voice in these letters and to have a sense of the kind of person that she was. This is my grandmother's letter. My dear lovely children, I have received your letter. The news from you shook me to my depth, but we are believers, and I trust and believe, and my heart tells me that we all will overcome everything. And when again we will get together, we will tell each other the stories. Therefore, please, I ask you, my dear children, do not worry about it. Don't take it to your heart, but be as you are now, brave and strong, and God will definitely keep you under his care and will not abandon you. Do not worry about us. We are not worse off than others. For the winter, we have again the same two barrels of sauerkraut as last year, potatoes and beans. Heshek, who was a cousin, and your friends were taken to Gornjak, that was a forced labor camp. One more time, I plead with you, be brave and all bad things will pass. I kiss you, Renya, my grandmother. On November the 12th, 1940, my mother gave birth to a second girl. They named her Ruja, which is rose in Polish, and that's me. Little by little, things got harder and harder. The Nazis forced the Jews to move out of their homes into a small section of the town and closed it off. The ghetto got more and more crowded as Jews from nearby villages were forced to leave their home and move into smaller and smaller quarters, which they had to share with other families. At this time, my parents, my grandparents, my sister and I, an aunt and an uncle, and another relative, nine people in all, lived together in two rooms and a kitchen. For 2 years, conditions kept getting worse and worse. There were more and more roundups and deportations to concentration camps and to forced labor camps. People died from disease and starvation. In August of 1943, the Vadovice ghetto was liquidated. That means that whoever had not yet died from disease or starvation, who had not yet been sent to the concentration camps or forced labor camps, whoever at this point was still alive, this was the moment where every single last person was being rounded up. It was a moment of terrible panic and fear. People were scrambling to hide in every conceivable and inconceivable place. It was in this moment of terrible panic that my mother had to make a most difficult decision. She had to decide whether she should keep her two babies with her and accompany her elderly, frightened parents to almost certain death, or should she desert her parents and try to hide with her husband and the two little ones? Or should she stay with her parents while her husband tries to hide with the two little ones? My mother accompanied her parents to Auschwitz, where they were murdered in the gas chambers. Meanwhile, my father had prepared a hiding place in the rafters of a house. There we hid all night long in the sweltering heat of an August attic, covering our mouths so no sound would escape and give us away. I don't know how long we stayed hidden, but eventually we crawled out of our hiding place into the deserted streets of our ghost town. My father carried me in his arms and my sister on his back, crawled in the ditch between the road and the fields in order not to be discovered, making his way back to Bielsko. I mentioned earlier that my father was involved in the Communist Party. It was one of his comrades who my father now sought out. She was a Christian woman, an innkeeper, and my father's friend. This Chasida Umot HaOlam, which translates as Hebrew, translates into the righteous among the nations. And I truly regret that I do not know her name. She took us in and was willing to risk her life to save us. We stayed with her for a short time while she and my father tried to figure out what to do next. Because communists were also being rounded up, and because my father had lived in Bielsko and people knew that he was a Jew, they decided that they had a better chance of survival if they could cross over to Czechoslovakia and meet up with a larger cell of their comrades. They boarded a train with Helen and me, with Helenka and me. We didn't sit together. We were with the woman. My father sat alone. The train was stopped by a Nazi convoy. And as fate would have it, one of the people in the convoy was from Wadowice. He recognized my father and he pointed, "There's a Jew." And they took my father off the train. They shot and killed him. The innkeeper took us back to her home and continued to hide us. There were occasions when the Nazis came searching for us because some Nazi sympathizer reported his suspicions that the innkeeper was hiding Jews. At those times, we were rushed down into the cold cellar. They used to store potatoes, beans, grains in the cellar. It was a cold place. They placed us in a large, or the innkeeper placed us in a large wooden barrel used for storage, grains, and so forth. We were in the wooden barrel, a cloth covering us, and poppy seeds poured on top. And I remember very, very vividly curling up into a small ball, holding my breath, my heart pounding, and my throat closing up with fear, as the Nazis poked their rifles into the barrel, making sure that no one was hidden within. After a few such close calls, our rescuer realized that it was only a question of time before we would be discovered. She asked two sisters who came selling eggs and milk from their nearby farm, if they would take us in. These two women, Julia and Anna, also righteous among the nations, each had large families of their own, and they passed us off as their nieces from a bombed-out village. My sister lived with Anna, and I lived with Julia. But we saw each other every day as she tended goats and I took care of geese. I remember one time going to church and being terribly terribly frightened because I had to make a decision. I knew that as a Jew, I'm not allowed to kneel and cross myself. But I also knew that if I didn't kneel and cross myself, they would know that I was a Jew and that I would be killed. And so I tormented about what to do. Eventually, I kneeled and crossed myself, and I prayed that God would forgive me. A few years ago, I found out why I had to be in church that one time. I also remember on several occasions the Nazis would come searching on the farm, and at those times I had to hide. The family would move a bed, lift the floorboards. I would crawl into the space between the subfloor and the floor, the boards put back into place and the bed back into place. We lived on the farm until the end of the war. And then one day, my sister was taken from her family by a Jewish organization and brought to Lodz, which was a large city quite a distance away. She kept crying for her sister, and they thought that she had become attached to the Christian children on the farm, and they kept reassuring her, "Don't worry, this isn't your real family. You'll have a new family, don't worry." But she would not be appeased, and she kept crying, "You don't understand, you don't understand. I want my sister, I want my sister." Until finally they went back and they found me. I remember so vividly getting off the train, seeing my sister across the platform, running into each other's arms, embracing and holding on for dear life. One of the leaders in this place in Lodz must have reminded my sister of our father because she attached herself to him. His name was Yechiel Granitstein. He felt sorry for us because we were among the youngest of the children who had survived, and we had no one except each other. And so he kind of adopted us. We called him Vetter, which is uncle in Yiddish. Eventually, we were smuggled out of Lodz to Prague, Czechoslovakia. Now you're probably asking, why did we have to be smuggled? Well, there was no country that was willing to take in the refugees, and so there was no alternative but to smuggle us out. I don't know, we were smuggled out to Prague, Czechoslovakia, where we were in a displaced persons camp, a DP camp. And I don't know how long we were in that camp. I was very young. I was approximately 5 years old at this point, and I had no sense of time. It could have been a week, it could have been a month, but eventually we were put on buses and sent to orphanages in France. We lived in France for about 4 years. They kept moving us from one orphanage to another. I'm not quite sure why they did that. In one case, the orphanage was very dilapidated, and in another case, the owner of this house came back and reclaimed it. For various reasons, we had to move from one orphanage to another. Altogether, we were in about 4 or 5 different orphanages. And I remember one time crying my heart out because Helenka, who had contracted tuberculosis, had to be taken to a sanatorium. Well, while we were at the orphanage, a Jewish American couple by the name of Eleanor and Sam Banker, came to visit the orphanage with the thought of adopting a child from the Holocaust, an orphan. Helenka and I were terribly malnourished. That's what the swollen belly is about. Our teeth were rotten, and our hands and feet were cracked and infected from frostbites because this last orphanage was in the French Alps, and we didn't have warm gloves and boots to protect us from the cold and the snow. In spite of this, the bankers decided that they would adopt us. The bankers paid Yechiel Granitstein, our fetter, to arrange all of the necessary documentation for us to get visas to come to America. This wasn't easy to do, and it took many, many months. And during these months, we lived with Yechiel and his family, Yechiel, Malka, and Shmuley, in Paris. Well, finally, on August the 30th, 1949, my sister Helenka and I boarded an airplane with our adopted mother, Eleanor Banker. We arrived at Idlewild Airport, which is now Kennedy in New York, on September the 1st. It was a gray, dismal day, and as I looked around at my surroundings, I remember thinking, "This is America?" We had been told that everything in America was beautiful, that even the streets are paved in gold. So you can imagine my disappointment as I looked at the airstrip thinking that this was America. We arrived at our beautiful new home in Interlaken, New Jersey, exhausted from our journey, and we were shown to our separate bedrooms and put to bed. But I had never slept alone, and I was terrified and crying. And so finally, I was allowed to join my sister in her room. A few days later, we stood at the corner of our block and waited for the bus to take us to our first day of school. We didn't speak a word of English, and I had never been to school. And so I think you can imagine how scared I was. By now, we had been given new American names. Helenka became Helen, and Luta, which is how I was called, became Ruth. Now, you heard earlier that my parents named me Ruja. I suspect that the name Luta was because my sister probably couldn't pronounce Ruja, and it came out sounding like Luta. Anyway, not knowing how old we were, our parents, judging from our size, arbitrarily gave us new birthdays. They guessed that I was around 7.5 years old and that Helen was about 9. Now, I want you to imagine how it feels not to know how old you are or where you were born or what happened to your parents. Who were they? What were their names? Helen and I lived with these questions until we were in our 20s, when something quite miraculous happened. And I'm going to tell you about that in just one moment. But first, I want to tell you what we did know. We knew that terrible things were happening to the Jews. We knew that we were Jewish and that we would be killed if anyone found out. We're pretty sure that our parents had been killed, but there was always a nagging hope that maybe we were wrong, that maybe somehow they had survived and they would come back and find us. And we knew that we had only each other, that we had to stay together and take care of one another. And now the story of the miraculous event. It's a long story, and I won't go into all of the details, but in 1962, our biological uncle, Isaac, one of the two who had crossed the Sanz River and survived in Russia, he was now living in Israel and had been searching for us. He finally found us. This was a major turning point in our lives. We found out that not only did we have this uncle, but that we had 8 more aunts and uncles and many, many cousins living in Israel. Our family gave us pictures of our parents and our grandparents. They gave us letters that my mother and my grandmother had written to them, and they shared with us all that they knew about what had happened to our family. And that's how we have been able to put together the pieces of what happened to us and our family during those terrible years. There have been other miracles that have enabled me to reconstruct my years of hiding. In 1984, my Aunt Matilda found the family that hid me. I visited with them in Poland at my first opportunity. Julia, the mother, was no longer alive, but three of her children, Władysława, Maria, and Stanislav, remembered me, and I learned a lot about what happened from them. They're the ones that told me that their mother had gotten me from another woman. They told me that she was a communist, that she was my father's friend and innkeeper. And when I asked, did they know her name, they said no, they did not know who she was. And I asked what happened to her. They said she was killed by the Nazis for hiding Jews. They also told me why I had to be in church that one time. You see, they had an older brother who was old enough to serve in the army, and he didn't want to serve. And so periodically the Nazis would come searching for him, and he had to get into a hiding place. At those times, they didn't want to take any risks, so I also had to go into hiding. That's when I went under the floorboards. Well, one of the times that they came searching for him, he didn't get into his hiding place in time, and they shot and killed him. My one time in church was at his funeral. They also solved a mystery for me, because for years, I used to try to remember what happened. Something happened where I had gotten some scars. I have a finger that doesn't straighten up. I have a scar here, a little scar here, a few little scars. And I knew something had happened. I could not remember the event. And when I noticed Stanislav has some fingers missing, and I asked him what happened, he was very surprised that I didn't remember. He's a year older than I am, and we were playmates. And one day we were in the woods, and he picked up something that he thought was a rock, only it turned out to be an explosive. He lost his fingers, and I caught the shrapnel. So the mystery is solved, although I still have no memory of the event. Upon my return home, I immediately applied to Yad Vashem, which is the Holocaust Remembrance Museum in Jerusalem, to have Julia recognized as a righteous among the nations. 20 years after my first application, my efforts finally came to fruition. Two summers ago, my husband Jerry, my three children, my niece Tammy, and from Israel, three cousins and a friend, came to support me through an emotional journey back to Poland and to share with me the beautiful ceremony bestowing upon my rescuer, Julia Vala, the Chassidei Umot HaOlam, the Righteous Among the Nations Award. Sharing this experience with my family has meant so much to me, because now that they have actually been to the places that I've spoken about, have met Julia's family, and in some way have relived my years of hiding, they too now own the story. It belongs to them as well. And so now I am confident that my story will live on. We went back to Buchkavice, which is the village where I was hidden, to Vadislava's home, which is also Helena's home. My cousin Yigal from Israel stopped me in front of the home where I was hidden for me to say a prayer of thanks that my life was spared at this location. It was a very emotional moment for me. I'd like to share an excerpt from the speech that I made at the ceremony. So this is part of the, this is the excerpt. Although I have only a few memories of that time, I am grateful beyond words for the kindness and compassion that Julia Vala displayed in risking her life and the lives of her family in order to protect me. Julia's courage not only saved my life, it has shaped me and enabled me to live with optimism because I was blessed to experience goodness in that time of horror. I look around me today and I see Julia's granddaughter and her great-grandchildren who might not have been born had she been caught. And I see my children who would not have been born had she not taken me in. How many souls are not here today, and how much poorer are we all because there weren't more Julias? We have a responsibility and an obligation to perpetuate the legacy that Julia has left us, that each of us has the power and the obligation to make a difference in the world. Now, it's true that, thank God, most of us are never faced with such life-threatening situations requiring of us this degree of courage. But in our day-to-day lives, there are many times when we are confronted with situations that offer us opportunities to do the right thing. I know that it often feels as though the little that we do is of little significance, but I'm asking you, please, please understand that even a small act of kindness, relieving a child's fear even for an hour, or a man's hunger if only for a day, or restoring dignity to a fallen person, even for one moment, it means a lot. Believe me when I tell you that to the downtrodden, just one moment of relief is as if you have given him life. In the beginning, I spoke about the devastation that one evil man wrought, but he didn't succeed in his goal. In the Jewish tradition, our sages teach us that he who saves one life saves the world. And here is living proof of that. My husband and me with our three children and six grandchildren. And with that, I invite your questions, comments. The question is, how did I fit under the floorboards? Well, remember, I was about 3 years old at the time, and I was small, so I was able, you know, it was big enough space, I was able to fit under there. Yes?
Did you mainly hide under the floorboards?
On the farm, mostly I did not hide. Most of the time, they passed me off as, you know, one of their nieces, and I was out in the fields most of the time taking care of the geese, my sister with the goats. So it was only on those rare occasions when the Nazis came searching for their brother that they did not want to take any risk, any chance. And those were the few times that I had to hide under the floorboards. And when I went back my first time to visit, to meet with Vladislava, Maria, and Stanislav, they actually showed me the space where I was hidden. And they showed me the space where their brother would go into hiding. Yes, honey?
Did you live with the bankers then until, how did your life live in New York?
Great question. Yeah, we continued to, you know, live with the bankers until my mother and my father died only a few years. My mother died quite a few years ago, but my father only died about 6 years ago. He ended up living with us, my sister and me. They were wonderful people. We had a very happy, good life, thank God. We became fully American. I think you can probably hear I have very little accent. I don't know if you hear any accent at all. There's a theory that if you learn a new language before the age of 9 or 10, thereabouts, you can lose the accent. And, you know, my parents guessed that I was 7.5 years old, but in reality, I was almost 9 years old when I came. But I went all through school thinking that I was much younger than I actually was. And it was a bit of a trauma when I found out that I was older, because my mental image of myself was that I'm very mature. I mean, after all, I developed earlier than everybody. I was more serious than most of my friends and very, very mature. And now I find out I'm actually a year and a half older. And now I have to rethink about who I am. I'm actually slow. So it was a little bit of a interesting psychological adaptation. Yes, honey?
How many different languages do you speak?
How many languages do I speak? That's a good question. Really good question. My sister and I spoke Polish with each other. And this really gets into some very interesting stuff. While we lived in France, we were always within the orphans. We stayed with the orphan, we always traveled together. We weren't out into French society. We did take walks, mostly hikes up mountains and stuff like that, but we had very little interaction with the French people. However, because my sister was taken to a sanatorium, which was run by nuns, and she lived there for about 6 months, she learned French. She was in a French hospital, and she came back, and we learned a little bit of French. So we spoke a little bit of French, not fluent. Now, I should show you this. I mentioned that it wasn't easy to get the documentation for us to come to America. You see, there were all kinds of quotas, and the Polish quota was filled. There was no room for Polish people to come into America. This is my passport to come to America, and the passport says that I was born in Breslau, Germany. I could come in on a German quota. Because we really had no documentation. At that time, we did not know that we were from Wadowice, Poland. We didn't know where we were from. And so they could make up whatever they want. Now, because we spoke Polish, we were from Lodz and so forth, they knew we were from Poland, but there was no proof of anything. So on this documentation, it was easier to say that we were from Breslau, Germany. So when we came to America, our parents wanted us to forget Polish because that would give us away. And they wanted to encourage us to speak French. So we went every week to the home of a woman to have conversational French. But every week we knew less and less. Why? Because when our parents said that they wanted us to forget Polish, we didn't distinguish between Polish and French or whatever. We knew that they wanted us to speak English. And my sister and I made a vow between ourselves that from this moment on, we will only speak English. So we forgot French, we forgot Polish. It was very hard for me in high school to learn a new language. I had a mental block. And it took many, many years until I began to, again, learn languages. And my husband's family lives in Mexico, so I learned Spanish. I know a little Spanish. Some of the French comes back because he also went to, he lived in France and his family also speaks French. So, and I have studied Hebrew, and so I speak Hebrew. I am not fluent in any of those. I'm only fluent in English. But I can get by in Spanish, French, Hebrew. Any other questions? Yeah.
When you were on the farm, where did the brother have to hide?
There was a cupboard. I guess they would store like big pots or something, but they emptied it out and he would go into the cupboard. Yes?
When you hid it in the barrel, would you ever not be able to breathe or something? Because you said that there was seeds on top of you.
When I was hidden in the barrel,
Could you breathe?
Yes, of course I could breathe. They put cloth, you know, there was a cloth that covered me, so it's not like the poppy seeds were, you know, if I took a breath that they were coming into my mouth or whatever. It was like a cheese, not cheesecloth, like a silken, you know, cloth that protected me. Yes.
Why, when you came to America, your parents didn't want you to speak Polish?
Because my passport says that I'm from Germany. And so they didn't want people to get suspicious. You know, if you guys want to have me deported, all you have to do is tell the immigration that I'm here on false documents. You know, I mean, I could have been deported at that time. I don't think it would work right now, so don't worry about it. Yeah. I've been too good of a citizen all these years. I don't think they would do that. Yes. Go ahead. Any other medical problems? Well, I didn't, except I needed glasses and I didn't know it. I was, you know, it was a long time before I realized how nearsighted I was. But my sister did the tuberculosis that she had contracted in Europe when she was in high school. It did recur and she needed a second treatment. And as a result of the medication that she then had to take twice, which is very, very strong medication, she did develop, her kidneys failed, and eventually she had to be on dialysis, and about 10 years ago she had a kidney transplant, so thank God she's doing okay. I'm trying to think if there were any other, you know, serious repercussions. Yes.
How did you meet your husband?
Oh, great question. well, I went to college in Boston. I was at BU, and he was at Tufts Dental School. They're both in the Boston area. And because we are both Sabbath-observing Jews, we met in the synagogue in Brookline, which was, you know, near my school and near his school. So that's how we met.
Do you regret losing the Polish language? Like, do you wish you could relearn that?
That's a great question. I do. I really do, because it connects me to my childhood. And even though it's really strange to understand this, even though there was a lot of trauma involved in my childhood, it's very precious to me. I mean, it's who I am. It's my identity. And so when I smell something that reminds me of Europe, I remember walnut trees. We used to pick up the walnuts and the bitterness, if any of you have ever peeled a walnut. I mean, that fragrance, and I remember rum chocolate balls, and so fragrances and songs, anything that brings back my youth is very precious to me. Polish is one of those things, and of course it would also make it much easier for me to be able to communicate with, I am still very much in contact with the Vala family in Poland. And it would be easier for me to communicate with them and so forth. I learned Hebrew because my aunts and uncles in Israel didn't speak English, and I wanted to be able to communicate with them. And so I studied Hebrew in order to be able to have a relationship with them. So yeah, Polish would be wonderful. In fact, we made a second trip back to Poland. My sister and our family from Israel, we all traveled. And my sister and I were on LUT Airlines, which is the Polish airplane, and we were surrounded. Everybody was speaking Polish, and I was hoping and thinking that it would come back, but nothing has come back. The only word that I have relearned is Chochu, which means aunt, and that's how I called Julia Chochu. Yeah.
Coming here at the age you came here, how long did it take you to assimilate? Did you feel ever like an average, what you would think of as an average American kid? And did you know any, have you, at a younger age, did you meet anybody who had come to America the same?
Oh, good questions. I love your questions. Thank you very much. Yes, so the question is, how long did it take me to feel assimilated, feel comfortable as an American, and were there, did I ever meet other children or people who had a similar experience? It took me almost no time at all to get adjusted. You have to keep in mind that we were constantly having to adjust to new situations. We, in order to survive, we had to be very adaptable. First, you know, we lost our parents, and we had to be comfortable with the innkeeper. And then this new family on the farm, and then we're in Ludge. And wherever we were constantly being changed and in new surroundings, and we had to be adaptable. So this was just another adaptation, which came very easily for me, much harder for my sister. She was older, and I think she also remembered more. Now, did we know other children? Well, actually, the man who helped arrange our adoption had also adopted a girl from the orphanage, and we were friends. We remained, I mean, they lived in another city, but we saw each other frequently. And we were also aware that there were three other families that had adopted children from the orphanage. We never saw those children until the first one that I reconnected with was about 15 years ago, and the next one was only about 4 years ago. And it's just, there have been so many miracles that have, the one of the pictures that I showed you of me and Piazinka and Javi, the three of us in the second orphanage in Fublan, 4 years ago, through Javi, whom I found by some miracle, she told me about Honda, who was the counselor who took care of me, who took care of the three of us. She was about 18 years old and also a survivor of the Holocaust. Her father was a doctor, and he became the director of this second orphanage, and her mother was the cook there. Honda lives in L.A., California, and I have since visited with her, and she's like another mother to me. She's just, she, when I told her on the telephone that I got her number from Javi and that I was in the orphanage in Fublan, her question was, how were you called? And I said, I was Luta. And she went, oh, Luta, my little girl. And I just, somebody remembered me as little Luta. And so it's just been a wonderful experience having her in my life again. In fact, in February, I was speaking at my granddaughter's school in L.A., and since Honda lives there, I invited her to come to the talk, and I introduced the talk by saying, we have a mystery guest today. And when we got to the part of the story where I am in the second orphanage, I invited Honda to come up and introduced her, and we were just, all of us in tears. It was just very moving. Any other questions? Yeah.
You said your sister works at this Jewish organization or something, so what's your job?
What is my job?
Yeah.
You mean now, what do I do, or... I'm not sure about your question. Go ahead. Don't be scared.
No, my friend Maddie asked me to ask it, and she didn't really put anything specific, so yeah.
What do you do for your job? Like, what's your job?
Oh, okay. Very good. Thank you. You know, I got married in an era where women didn't necessarily hold jobs. And so I was a homemaker. I raised the children. But I was what I would call a professional volunteer. I worked more hours and harder at volunteer work than most people do in their regular jobs. And I held every kind of position that you can imagine. Ultimately, I became the president of the Jewish Federation, which is the umbrella organization for the Jewish community in our county. I was also on national boards and stuff like that. About 12 years ago or something, I organized a dialogue group between Arabs and Jews. It was called Project Understanding. I've worked with Mental Health Association. I actually had a young girl who was being taken from her family and was going to be put in a foster home, and I took her into my home for several months so she could graduate with her class and so forth. So this is the kind of, you know, some people collect stray dogs or cats or whatever. I collect people. I'm always in the business of helping people. And I think it's very understandable why I would be that kind of person, right? I mean, my life having been saved by people who are willing to help, you know, I feel like I need to. It's not a conscious awareness, but I'm sure it's in my, you know, in my core, that the need to give back and to help others.
Whatever happened to Shmuley?
Oh, great, great question. Yechiel and Malka eventually moved to Jerusalem, to Israel, and Shmuley is living in Israel. He's now a grandfather. And when I go to Israel, Yechiel died 2 years ago. That's his father. But Shmuley is still alive, and whenever I go to Israel, I used to visit with Yechiel and Malka, and now I visit with Shmuley when I go to Israel. Thank you for that question. Thank you, all of you, for your wonderful questions and your attention, and thank you.
You've been listening to a program from the Durham Museum Lecture Series on Noon Forum. We've heard a talk by Ruth Rosenfeld, a survivor of the Nazi Holocaust. In recognition of Holocaust Remembrance Day, the Durham Museum has partnered with the Institute for Holocaust Education and the Jewish Federation, as well as Beth Israel, Beth El, and Temple Israel synagogues, to co-sponsor this special presentation. Mrs. Rosenfeld, the mother of Jewish Community Center Omaha Executive Director Aaron Rosenfeld, was born in Wadowice, Poland. She has served as president of the Jewish Federation of Monmouth County, New Jersey, and has received the Hannah Solomon Award from the National Council of Jewish Women as the founder of Project Understanding, which is a dialogue group between Arabs and Jews. Part of the audience for today's program was made up of students from St. Cecilia's Grade School, Duchenne Academy, the Omaha Street School, as well as homeschool groups. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Tuesday morning, April 17, 2012, for broadcast at this time. Special thanks to Shauna Forsberg, Director of Marketing and Public Relations at the Durham Museum, for helping to make the recording and broadcast of this program possible. Complete Noon Forum listings, as well as an archive of over 200 previous programs, are available on our website, kios.org. Now, this is your producer and host, Bob Cote, thanking you for listening.